eyes, what are we preparing to defend? Town meeting tonight.
Welcome, members of America's town meeting of the air from coast to coast. Hold fast to the liberty you are enjoying tonight. For once again, the American system of radio unites you in a great nationwide town meeting. What are we preparing to defend? This is one of the things we are preparing to defend, the right to meet and reason together about our common problems. You will not want to miss receiving your copy of tonight's broadcast, so listen carefully at the end of the program, and we will tell you how to get tonight's and all town meeting broadcasts this season. It is my pleasure now to present our moderator, Mr. George B. Dent, Jr., president of Town Hall and founder of America's Town Meeting of the Air. Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. Each week our circle grows larger as more mission clubs are formed in school, colleges, and all kinds of community organizations throughout the country. A town hall movement in the defense of democracy is underway. We seek unity through understanding, and tonight we are seeking the essence of democracy. What are we preparing to defend? A way of life which we hope to fight as we face aggressive totalitarianism on two fronts. Will we fall as other democracies have fallen before us, or is our democracy so strong, so sound, so robust that we can resist the forces from within and without that are aligned against us? Democracy has been defined as a constitutional form of government, a system of checks and balances, parliamentary assembly, popular suffrage, periodic elections, and a Bill of Rights. It is based upon respect for the individual, and while adhering to the principle of majority rule as a fundamental tenet of democracy, the right minorities to full privileges of citizenship are not abridged under this form of government. It is the aim of democracy to give the fullest measure of freedom to the individual to develop his maximum capacities, so long as this development does not interfere with the welfare and the rights of others. And please note this carefully. Democracy presupposes a system of universal education and the dissemination of unbiased news and information on a basis which will permit of an honestly informed public opinion. That definition is taken from our handbook for discussion leaders for town meeting groups. While a simple statement such as this can cover the case completely, I understand our speakers agree to this as far as it goes. To lead us in our discussion this evening, we have the distinguished American philosopher and writer Harry A. Overstreet, who is president of the American Association for Adult Education and a trustee of Town Hall. As our second speaker, we have Mr. Colby Chester, chairman of the Board of General Foods Corporation Manufacturers. Following their addresses, Mr. Stanley High, journalist and town hall lecturer, now on the staff of the Reader's Digest, will act as our special interrogator. It's now my pleasure to present our first speaker, Dr. Harry A. Overstreet. Dr. Overstreet.
Mr. Denny, ladies and gentlemen, a strong defense of our country requires a strong conviction that the country is worth defending. Of late years, there has been a growing cynicism among us about our own land, a growing disillusion about its pretensions of life, liberty, and justice for all. America is promises, wrote Archibald MacLeish, but to many victims of our haphazard system, America has seemed chiefly broken promises. What is the America we are preparing to defend? Can we not say, first of all, clearly and strongly, what we are not preparing to defend? We are not preparing to defend racial discrimination in any of its forms. By this I mean anti-Semitism. By this I mean the denial to the Negro of the full rights of a human being. And I mean it particularly at this time, when Jim Crowism is threatening to be the law of the army. The Negro soldier must be treated as a full American citizen and not as a segregated pariah. How can we, without utter contempt for our own hypocrisy, ask any human being to defend a country that treats him with contempt? We are not preparing to defend the cowardly methods of Ku Kluxers, Silver Shirts, Black Eagles, or any other self-constituted group of snoopers, persecutors, and extra-legal lawmakers. We are not preparing to defend lynching in the North, East, South, or West. We are not preparing to defend poll tax slavery. We are not preparing to defend the right of corrupt political machines to own our cities, nor the right of state and national machines to grow strong through the spoils system. We are not preparing to defend the denial to any American citizen of his civil liberties, even though the denial be made in the name of national emergency. We are not preparing to defend governmental favors to powerful violators of the Labor Act. We do not remember that industry offered for patriotic reasons to take a loss. We do not see that labor should do what industry itself refused to do. We are not preparing to defend labor racketeering. We are not preparing to defend the perpetuation of poverty in the midst of plenty. We are not preparing to defend the enormous and irresponsible power exercised by the great owners of wealth. We are not preparing to defend any form of free enterprise that is a pious cloak for exploitation. These things we are not preparing to defend. Moreover, these things we are not preparing to condone. They are one and all a disgrace to America. We are a democracy. We intend to defend what is democratic. We cannot be half democratic and half anti-democratic and hope to be a strong people. A strong defense requires a strong conviction. We cannot have a strong conviction if we compromise the values in which we believe. Our democratic way of life is a way of respect for all human beings. This respect calls for more than verbal acceptance. To defend democracy, we must act out democracy. At this time of crisis, what are the ways in which we can act out democracy? A first way is to practice freedom of discussion. It is to listen to what the other fellow has to say, even though what he says is to us anathema. Without free and generous discussion, democracy is dead. A second way is to extend and enrich all the educational opportunities of our people, from infancy through adulthood. To curtail education in the name of defense would be to weaken that very defense. A powerful people must be an enlightened people. A third way is to increase among us all the possible forms of voluntary cooperation. Democracy is a way of associating people together for their common welfare. Every consumer's cooperative puts into practice this voluntary, associated way of life. So does every credit union. So does every form of group medicine. So does every form of cooperative housing. The more effectively Americans learn how to work together for a common good, the more truly are they democratic in practice. A fourth way is by the further expansion of the method of insurance. Insurance is a pooling of the resources of all for the protection of each. It is the most effective and self-respecting way we know of meeting the disasters of unemployment and the diminished earning power of old age. Social insurance is democracy intelligently in action. A fifth way is to make our care for those in distress increasingly considerate. This holds for the community chest, for the Red Cross, for every community hospital. This holds for a willing, a generous, and a non-pauperizing form of relief for our unemployed. A sixth way is to do justice to the worker. For a long time, the worker has been the chattel slave of business, industry, and finance. We make our democracy come alive when we give the worker the chance to stand equal with the employer. Those who oppose or evade or violate collective bargaining, in letter or in spirit, are foes of democracy. A seventh way is for the worker, in his millionfold power, to do justice to himself, to his employer, and to the public. A racketeering union that has become not a service agency for the rights of labor, but a gangster agency that gyps labor, employer, and public alike has no place in a democracy. Finally, there is an eighth way. Perhaps it is the most important of all. We began as a nation of communities. As we have grown in numbers and complexity, our communities, in the final sense, have almost vanished. We are a nation of people who do not know one another and who have too largely lost the art of thinking and working together. What we basically need in America is to recover the spirit and the strength of the community. The best defense of America will come not from the top down, but from the bottom up, from the thousands of communities that are coming alive to their common needs and their common problems. But these eight ways of acting out democracy are not yet enough. We shall not fulfill our democratic aims until we have contrived somehow, by some means, to guarantee to every American a decent living wage. Millions of Americans today are without such wage. Millions are the victims of undernourishment, miserable housing, and lifelong insecurity. We have begun to see our obligation to the unemployed. We shall someday see our obligation to the marginal worker. Again, we shall not fulfill our democratic aims until we have learned somehow, by some means, to let the rich abundance of our land flow into the lives of all our people. An economic system that halts that flow, that diverts it into the control of a few, is an economic system that democracy must drastically overhaul. We have a grand tradition to defend. It is the tradition of a free people, freely dedicated to the achievement of liberty and justice for all. One of the boldest statements in all history is our American declaration that all men are created equal. It was laughed at in its day. It has been laughed at since. But in spite of its apparent absurdity, it was then and still remains the fundamental expression of American democracy. All that we ever intended in America, we still intend. This means that we have, first of all, to defend our right to grow peacefully by trial and error, by observation and fumbling, by learning now this and now that. We have to defend ourselves against fixation by command. But in order to grow, we must be free, free to think and discuss, free on our ballots to say no if we mean no. We must be free in our worship, free in our choice of occupation. Our press must be free. Teachers and scientific researchers must be free in their search of truth. If these freedoms go, everything goes. For only out of the full liberty of the spirit can wisdom and justice increase among us. There is something utterly basic about this right to be free. All life, all government has to change. There are, however, two ways of change, the way of violence and the way of reason. Violence accomplishes change swiftly and dramatically, but it accomplishes it by doing violence to people, to human nature itself. It gives people no time for the slow processes of growth. It makes them over by command. But a whole people cannot be made over by command. Change to be genuine must be a change wrought in their minds, their hearts, their habits. Only the free way of reason can bring about such deeper change. This is the way of democracy. It is such essential freedom that the whole totalitarian system despises and denies. It glorifies the God-man who says the saving word. To us, this God-man seems far more like a monster who says the enslaving word. It glorifies submission to the state. We believe in the consent of the governed. It glorifies the dynamic lie. We believe in the freedom of truth. It glorifies violence. We believe in the ways of peace. It glorifies the oppression of the weak by the strong. In our civilization, even children scorn the bully. They say, pick on somebody your own size. In the totalitarian states, it has become a virtual command to pick on somebody, individual or small nation, that you're sure you can beat up. It is against all this utter perversion of life that democracy is prepared to defend itself. We are far from perfect. We fumble and fail. We commit injustice. We are cruel to our own people. But basically, the original intention still holds, to build a land where liberty, equality, and justice can be for all. We are prepared to defend our right to carry out this intention.
Thank you, Dr. Overstreet. I call your attention again to the fact that town meetings are not necessarily debates. We are trying to achieve unity through understanding, and we invite our speakers here to make their contributions. So if you don't get a debate tonight, don't be disappointed. We are trying to find an answer to a very important question, and I take great pleasure in presenting our next speaker, who will make his contribution to this subject, Mr. Colby Chester, Chairman of the Board of General Foods. Mr. Chester.
Mr. Moderator, ladies and gentlemen, plainly the question what we are preparing to defend has two implications, material values and spiritual values. Insofar as our material values are concerned, we are in general agreement, I think, that they include the United States and its possessions and the hemisphere obligations which we have assumed at different times in our history. But when it comes to spiritual values, we open a wide field of discussion. Representing just 130 millionth of the people of the United States, I welcome this opportunity to venture an opinion as to what we should be preparing to defend. I believe we should prepare to defend our representative democracy, our civil and religious liberty, and our freedom of opportunity and enterprise against any and all attempts to replace them with a totalitarian society. In short, I believe we must defend the Bill of Rights, those first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States with their eternal guarantees of the rights of the individual. I believe this is the most important duty facing the American people. I believe moral armament against creeping collectivism should gear in with military armament against the ruthless war machines of any and all dictators. I can see no sense in fighting a war against a totalitarian state from without, if at the same time we are surrendering to the totalitarian forces from within. Probably everyone realizes how collectivism really works. Sinclair Lewis has told us clearly, and it can't happen here. And many other able men and women have explained it on the radio or in print. Let's pause for a moment just to see how it works in an ordinary American family. Bill Jones, his wife, son, and daughter are huddled in their home. A gun butt crashes the door. The secret police take Bill away, as well as the car and radio. An official comes in and tells Bill's wife what their food rations will be. And they won't be much. Another official tells the mother and daughter that they will have to get along with one dress apiece per year. The boy is to be taken out of school to work in a munitions plant. If Mrs. Jones protests, she is struck on the mouth. Orders will come as to how to spend each hour of the day, where to work, when to laugh, to cheer, to salute, what to read, what to say, what to think, and no longer to worship as they please. Any violations will be punishable by imprisonment, torture, or death. But people will ask, is there any real danger of dictatorship here? Well, a lot of people in Europe asked that question and then woke up too late. They had allowed the collectivists to inch their way into one power after another until they assumed entire control of business enterprise. People didn't realize that that meant the eventual death of free speech and the end of personal liberty would follow in short order. You know as well as I that powerful dictatorship propaganda is being spread throughout America. You know as well as I that there are some people in this country who have convinced themselves that democracy is through, and that there is nothing to be done about it but accept it as an accomplished fact. You know, too, that this is about the last peaceful citadel of democracy in the world today, and that if it goes down here, the hopes of mankind will be blasted for years, if not centuries to come. Oh, these proponents of the new order are very subtle about it. To the discouraged, they paint a rather rosy picture. But to the inquiring mind, they are neither definite nor convincing. Perhaps you have been more successful than I in getting a blueprint of what kind of a state those who want to give up democracy have in mind for our America. It seems to me, if we are going to consider seriously giving up what we have had for 165 years, we ought to know exactly what the alternative is. Now, in supporting our present democratic way of life, I do not suggest sticking blindly to status quo. I know there are always, have been and always will be, improvements needed in a democracy, at least until the golden rule becomes universal practice. But I am persuaded that our democracy is better than any other existing system of government and has within itself all the needed machinery to correct its errors and improve the lot of its citizens. No one, for example, should want to surrender lightly the opportunity of a man or a woman to purchase more of the necessities of life for 1 hour's work in America than can be purchased for an hour's work in any dictator country. Many of our listeners tonight are members of labor unions. Most of them know what happens to labor unions under a dictatorship. They know that collective bargaining stops, hours of work lengthen, and wages go down. Many of you listeners carry insurance and have some money in savings banks, and still others have homes or farms or small investments. You know that sooner or later collectivism puts an end to all property rights. Most of you have a religious faith. You know religion is one of the dictator's chief hates. It would be very stupid of a businessman who didn't want everybody to have a job, a steady and a well-paid job. If you are in business, you must have customers with money to buy your products and your services. You must have such customers so that you can pay the men and women who work in the factories and stores. You must have customers in order to pay taxes for defense and other governmental needs. You must be able to earn a fair rate of interest on investment in industry to keep the support of your stockholders, including the banks and insurance companies who invest the public's money. Perhaps you are not aware that the average cost of providing the machinery and other expenses to add just one extra worker in a factory is more than $5,000. Therefore, it is the utmost public concern that we keep open the green traffic signal for the investment of capital in order to expand business and hence employment. I don't believe any of you would want to invest $5,000 of your savings in a business unless you were reasonably sure that you would be paid a fair dividend or interest. And you wouldn't want to lose your $5,000 capital by seeing the business you invested in fail because of unfortunate political laws, rulings, labor situations, or public attitudes. I fully recognize the needs of rules in the game to protect the public from abuses, but the restrictions should be no more than is necessary, and they should be accompanied by an attitude of encouragement to proper job-building enterprise at all times. No nation willingly abandons its liberty when business is good, when a large majority of its citizens have jobs and reasonable living wages, and when there is a proper degree of personal and public security. It is when a nation is hungry and in despair that it surrenders its liberty to a dictator. Therefore, it is of the utmost importance for the preservation of our democracy that our business life be made to flourish for the benefit of all. And this can be done without the surrender of a single principle of our present system. The needed steps for a sound economic life have already been outlined by leaders of government, agriculture, labor, industry, and education. In barest summary, these steps call for the maintaining of all our liberties, our Constitution, and our way of life. They call for the creating of even greater individual opportunity. Certain legislative changes are needed to unleash frozen capital in order to stimulate new enterprise and create more jobs. There has been a great mass of legislation in recent years, and experience has already shown that here and there, changes are imperative. None of these changes would in any way impair the rights of labor, the investor, the consumer, or general public. On the other hand, such changes would result in all-around benefits. In the field of business, I want to assure you that today there is a great sense of obligation, of stewardship. There has been a rapid growth in labor organizations, and many labor leaders likewise realize that it is their responsibility, too, to make business prosper. The churches and schools can help tremendously by giving the public the most thorough education about our economic and social system and how it is interwoven with our daily lives. Speaking as one of many thousand businessmen from all parts of America who are in a series of meetings this week, I want to reaffirm the attitude which we have expressed many times before. Industry not only wants to cooperate with government, labor, and all other groups in our national life, but it believes such cooperation is overdue. And without it, we can never adequately prepare ourselves for the ordeal before us. But this meeting around the council table must be in the spirit of patriotic devotion. Let's not merely take a defensive attitude about our democracy. While we are correcting its faults, let's aggressively sell the American way. The best defense is a strong offense. That is common sense. That is the way to win. That is the American way. It was St. Paul who said, "Hold fast to that which is good." Ladies and gentlemen, that was good advice 2,000 years ago. It is good advice today. Let's make the many good things in this land of ours the foundation for a newer and a better structure of American democracy, so that it will provide more than ever before for the security and happiness of all of our people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We pause now for station identification. This is America's Town Meeting of the Air, discussing the question, what are we preparing to defend? We just heard the remarks of our speakers, Dr. Harry A. Overstreet and Mr. Colby Chester, and now it's the turn of our special interrogator, Mr. Stanley High, who has opinions and questions of his own. Mr. High.
I have very few opinions and a few questions. the purpose of which chiefly is to discover whether there is some common meeting ground between these two speakers, an area in which we can agree this is the thing we are seeking to defend. I gather that both speakers are against sin and for God, and that's reassuring. I gather also that Mr. Chester's definition of what is sin and who is God would probably differ from that of Mr. Overstreet's. Therefore, I think it's perfectly justifiable to explore this matter a little farther. Now, both speakers, in describing the America that we have to defend, emphasized particularly the economic aspects of America. They talked about our economic system. They almost talked about our economic system as though the America we have to defend is our economic system. I'm anxious, first of all, to know, I'm going to ask Professor Overstreet this question, is whether or not our economic system and our democracy are that inseparable. Do you believe, Professor Overstreet, that we can't have one without having the other? If we lose one, we must lose the other.
Well, Mr. High, I've got to answer that by, I'm sorry, but I'd have to ask you what you mean by our economic system. Our economic system is a various thing. It's been growing since the days of our colonial history. It's a very imperfect system now, and I should say that our democracy is not inseparable with the kind of capitalism we have today.
I want to ask in a different way that same question from Mr. Chester in the hope that we can find some approximate ground of understanding here. Mr. Chester, do you think that there are certain non-economic values which we ought to prepare to defend regardless of what happens to our economic system? That is, that despite the fate of capitalism, there are still some things left that we ought to be willing to die for, non-capitalistic things.
Without question.
I'd like to go a little farther and ask more specifically, what are some of these things that we ought to be prepared to die for, non-economically?
Freedom, religion, right to move and have our being. I think the Bill of Rights covers them pretty well. Would you be a little more specific and tell me what you're leading up to?
I'm leading up to Mr. Chester right now, but it occurred to me that our economic system was not as it now is when America was founded. Neither did the founders of America set out to establish an economic system. What they set out to establish was something quite different from an economic system. They were worried about economics. They were also worried about politics, but there were some things they were sure of. Now, it seems to me it's important that we should agree in the area where our forefathers, the non-economic, even the non-political area, in which our forefathers were agreed.
Well, I think that a lot of water has gone over the dam in 165 years, and maybe we should stop and look back and see if we have made progress in the right direction. Most of us were born into a system that, as it exists today, and seriously, I think we've been trying to make the best of it in our own way. And I'm not hidebound to this system. I've been exploring in my own mind what kind of a system is going to provide more happiness for all the people, because that's really what life is all about. It's to get the most happiness for all of us. So I'm just definitely open-minded, Mr. High, and if anybody's got a better system, I'd like to hear.
Well, I think we're. Seems to me we're closer to agreement than I dared to hope we'd be. Now, you'll notice that neither of these speakers, however, although they spoke about our economic system, neither of them was particularly satisfied with it on the hoof, so to speak. That is, they both made it very plain that they weren't entirely sold on the system as it is. Now, I think in regard to some of these things that are wrong with it, some of this effort at making this system defensible, we might also get agreement there. Mr. Chester said, we've got to defend ourselves in making this system defensible against the creeping paralysis of collectivism. Now, I would like to have Professor Overstreet comment upon whether or not he feels in his bones any such menacing threat of collectivism.
Well, since my DQ, Mr., that's a discontent quotient, isn't it?
That's right.
I got a DQ now. Since my DQ is high, is very, very high, I can answer, I think, very quickly. I'm not, my bones don't feel aching at an imminent collectivism in America. First of all, I think we Americans are too commonsensical. We've got too much way of self-reliance. We've managed our own affairs as individuals. If you go through Iowa and Kansas and Nebraska and Nevada and all the rest of them, you don't see collectivism under bed. I do believe that, to come to the question Mr. High was asking, there are many things about our present system which are very, very unfortunate. I think the excessive amount of absentee ownership is a very, very sad thing. It's a very demoralizing thing in our nation. The part that corporation plays now, and the manner in which the corporation is given privileges over people, is a very, very unfortunate thing. The excessive amount of private ownership of public resources is, I think, very, very unfortunate.
Mr. Christopher Overstreet really started a new argument instead of answering my question. But Christopher Overstreet's question himself, his list included a good many things, specifying those particulars that we should not defend. Among them, he said, we should not be preparing to defend the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, nor the enormous and irresponsible power exercised by the great owners of wealth. Now, I want to see if we can do any better with Mr. Chester in this area than we did with Mr. Overstreet. See whether or not I can alarm Mr. Chester, not as much as Mr. Overstreet was alarmed, but a little bit.
Well, are you asking me now whether...
I'm asking you whether you have any fear lurking around about the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few and the enormous and irresponsible power exercised by the great owners of wealth.
Well, I think that the way our taxes are going, there won't be much left in a very short time. And I think that's all to the good. I understand that the next Congress is anticipating to take away what might be handed on to the next generation and put a lot of people to work that have been living rather easily and taking life in high. And I don't think we're going to have to worry much about concentration of wealth in the succeeding generation.
Good. Thank you very much. That's just the point I wanted to reach. Mr. Overstreet, Professor Overstreet, in the course of his remarks, had some very hard, he had us hard at the business of acting out our democracy. He had us cast, as I recall it, in 8 different roles. They were very good roles he had us cast in, but I was rather amazed at some of the things he left out. He didn't, Professor Overstreet, he didn't once mention self-reliance, responsibility, industry, and ambition as being roles that Americans preparing themselves for defense should play, or being as a part of the American picture we ought to prepare to defend.
Well, Mr. High, being an academic logician, I'm always afraid of platitudinous abstractions.
You're not going to leave me with the... a belief that self-reliance, responsibility, industry, and ambition are abstractions.
They're very, very abstract. So abstract you can't see them.
Well, I wish I brought my speech up here. Your speech up here, only because I...
Seriously, let me answer your question, because I think there is some... it's very unfortunate to use words like that. In giving the 8 things we have to do in our democracy... we are giving the types of activities that make for self-reliance and industry and all the rest of these things. We cannot breed self-reliance abstractly in a vacuum. We have to have a plan for democracy.
Mr. Chester, necessary things for... an economy which would be defensible indicated that freedom was one of those things, that a free economy probably would hurry us along into the solving of these problems and therefore the preparing of an America more effectively to defend itself. I want to ask this question. If a free economy is what we need in 1940 to get us out of our mess, how does he answer the contention that it was the free economy of the 20s that got us into it?
I haven't got many of these $2 words to throw back at you.
I'm glad.
Well, there were a lot of things went on in 29 that I think when you put them under the head of free economy, you do injustice to the word free. Now, what happened in 29 was that the selfishness of people came to the fore, and of course it's still a human trait. The question of a free economy, as I understand it, is that every one of us has got an opportunity to go far as we can based on our ability to work, our ability to contribute, our ability to do something under a proper, reasonable set of laws that will see that we do not do injustice to anybody else. Now, there were a lot of laws that were so loose, or somebody got around them back there in 29, that it wasn't a free economy. There were a lot of privileges that some people exercised and never should have. I'm talking too long. But what I'm trying to say is that I don't think that we should absolutely condemn the philosophy of a free economy just because we pursued an unselfish economy back in 29 and got a lot of smart lawyers to show us how to evade the law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chester and Stanley High. Now it's the audience's turn to ask questions. Will you please rise and state the name of the person to whom your question is directed? The gentleman right there.
Dr. Overstreet.
Dr. Overstreet.
Do you think being a millionaire ought to be declared illegal?
No, I said in my speech that I do not believe in fixation by command. And I don't believe that you can put millionaires out by the command of government. Millionaires have to go out, very largely, as Mr. Chester was saying, by the evolution of our democratic intelligence. How's that?
Mr. Chester, do you believe that America should prepare to defend to see that the investor gets the proper rate of interest on his investment, or the more paramount objective of ensuring that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth?
The latter.
The National Association of Manufacturers has come out with the proposition that it is opposed to conscription of wealth in defense of this democracy. Now, will you please explain to me why it's all right to conscript human lives and take men away from their work and home and not to conscript wealth?
Will the gentleman tell me on what occasion the Manufacturers Association came out with that statement?
New York Times has it in today's issue.
Well, the New York Times has an advantage over me. I was not aware of any such resolution, and I'm opposed to it.
Are you opposed to conscription of wealth?
Not at all. I'm opposed to an attitude that wealth cannot be conscripted in an emergency where it's necessary.
In other words...
Next man.
Let's check.
In your opening remarks, you stated that our obligations of defense include the United States and its colonies. Do you believe that American boys should be prepared to defend and give up their lives for dear old Manila?
Well, all right. Mr. Moderator, I didn't attempt to get into a definition of what we should defend territorially. If we have an obligation to Manila, and I'm not a statesman, I think we should defend any obligation we've got. I don't know what our obligations, as I understand it. Manila is to be given its freedom in a certain time. If up to that time we have an obligation and a contract to defend it, I believe we should live up to it.
Doctor, I want to ask you if you think Negro men should go for the third time to fight for a country which segregates, lynches, and denies them the vote?
No. I think it's a very sad thing if this country continues the injustice to the Negro.
education must be free. Do you believe that the establishment of such committees as the Ralph Kuder Committee here in New York threatens such freedom?
All right. That's pretty concrete, Dr. Oglesby.
Well, no, my dear lady, you know more than I do. I don't know the names of those people. I don't know what the committee is, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I'm afraid that's a question that would not be understood outside of New York,
yes.
And we'd better rule it out and go on to the next question. The man in the box there, yes?
Mr. Oglesby. What are the national...
The man in the box, I said.
In your opening speech, you mentioned freedom of truth. Now, how would you overcome the very harmful effect that is produced by facts being falsified by newspapers and radio commentators?
Well, I'm not so sure that they are forced by newspapers and radio commentators. If they are, that's just one of the imperfect conditions of our present civilization. There's a lot of untruth in America today, but Mr. Chester and I have been talking about what are the basic attitudes of America. We don't want untruth to rule our land, but there is untruth in our land.
My question is for Mr. Chester. Mr. Chester, do you now believe, in the light of the recent bouquet thrown in Labour's direction by the German chief of state, that we in America now have to fear the same destruction of our capitalist system that we had formerly to fear only from the collectivists?
Well, Mr. Hitler's speech, I imagine. You're talking about Hitler's speech?
Yes.
Today? I don't believe anything Mr. Hitler says.
Against their violation, even though we are in a national emergency. And I'd like to know whether he really believes that's so, whether he believes allowing both fascists and communists to speak and do things freely, though it means inciting race hatred and such like things.
You believe that fascists and communists should speak in this national emergency?
No, she said something more than that. She said, should fascists and communists be allowed to speak and do things? They should not be allowed to do things. But they should be allowed to speak, because may I say that if we allow people to speak, it carries with it the like obligation that we become alert enough to know what they're talking about.
And the last row.
Mr. Chester, you warn against the encroachment of our liberties from within. Do you not think the proposed inquiry by the National Association of Manufacturers into the character of our school books but the prelude to further similar totalitarian practices that will endanger our free institutions?
Mr. Chester, I suppose that proposed inquiry of school books by the NAM was on the front pages of most papers in the country, so perhaps that's known. Do you care to comment on it?
I simply want to make this comment. The inquiry is simply a study as to what is being taught in the schools to be made available for anybody that wants to see what their children are being taught. There's no propaganda behind it. It's simply in the spirit of finding out what is actually going on. All right. That's the purpose of it. I can't tell you any more.
Before we close the question period tonight, I want to call your attention to the fact that we have a distinguished guest in one of the boxes here, Signora Isabel de Palencia, former minister from the Spanish Republic to Sweden, and author of the recent book, I Must Have Liberty. And she will, I'm sure, have something interesting to say to us, if we may have a couple of minutes from her before we go. Madam Palencia.
Moderator, I just want to express my satisfaction, my deep satisfaction, when I see that all the answers as to what you should be prepared to defend, what we should be prepared to defend, since you allow me so graciously, as a foreigner, a stranger, to take part in this evening's program. We are all prepared to defend democracy. And it, to me, it is a most promising thing for the future that the world should at last have realized that democracy is the system which, as a former speaker has said, can make people really happy. And if there is democracy, not only the moral values, not only the spiritual values will be defended, but also the material things will be defended through it. I only have a small regret, and that is that the world should not have realized that democracy had to be defended some time ago. In 1933, in 1935, in 1936, there were events in the world that would not have brought us to the situation that we are having today if democracy had been defended then. But perhaps it is because of history. After the great heroic struggles for democracy in the world came a lethargy when people were almost apologetic for being democratic. When people wanted their rights, the rights of democracy, but not the duties. When people were afraid of democracy, not only nationally in what refers to social reform, but internationally in upholding those international laws that the democratic countries had promised to uphold.
Thank you very much, Madam Blackie. And now it's time for me to take a question from Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Denny, what about that big news about the town meeting coast-to-coast tour and the telegram you received from Miami today?
Mr. Hamilton, continuing our policy of making town meeting a truly representative institution, we decided last spring to accept six of the many invitations we've received from American cities to originate these programs in their localities. With deep appreciation of all of these invitations, our committee decided this year to present programs beginning February 20th in Birmingham, Alabama, Los Angeles, California, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Des Moines, Iowa, ending on March 27th.
But about that telegram, Mr. Denny?
Well, tonight, confirming a verbal invitation from the Florida Congress on Democracy, we received the following wire from Mr. Richard Evans, its executive vice president, and I quote, City of Miami, through Mayor Alexander Orr and city commissioners, officially invite you to hold open-air town meeting in Bayfront Park, Miami, opening annual Florida Congress on Democracy. Subject, the role of youth in the defense of democracy. End quote. That is why we are interested in that subject, Mr. Hamilton, because it means that we'll speak to 10,000 youth in Miami. And I suppose we'll spend Christmas week in that city.
Good. And the many new Blue Network stations in the Southeast will carry the program.
Next week, we'll announce the program in full. Now, how about copies of tonight's program?
Every word of tonight's program will be printed in our bulletin, Town Meeting, published by Columbia University Press. We will gladly send you your copy. Just write Town Hall in New York City, enclosing 10 cents to cover our cost of printing and mailing. And to have your own copy of every one of the 26 broadcasts this season, send $2.50. Address Town Hall, New York City.
And next week's program on national defense?
Is America rearming efficiently? That is the question in the minds of every American in these times. And that will be the subject of next week's discussion when we will have as our speakers Mr. Boak Carter, the well-known journalist and radio news commentator, Mr. J. Franklin, Washington columnist for the Register and Tribune Syndicate, Mr. C.B. Allen, defense expert for the New York Herald Tribune and formerly on the Air Safety Board of the Civil Aeronautics Authority, and Mr. Kenneth G. Crawford, chief Washington correspondent for the new New York newspaper PM and formerly president of the American Newspaper Guild. The work of these men is to probe for the facts of the nation's business at Washington and report their findings to the American people. Next Thursday night, they will report to us on the subject, Is America Rearming Efficiently? Listen next week for the sound of the crier's bell. Same time, same station.
Is America rearming
efficiently.
This program has been presented as a public service to the National Broadcasting Company and the independent radio stations affiliated with the NBC Network, and has come to you from Town Hall in New York City.